Right. Well, we're very happy to, by the way, we will tell you more about actions coming up around the Dakota Pipeline at the end of the show. But right now, we're very happy to welcome our guests on air with us. We've got both Delia Carroll. Let's see. Delia is, hold on just a moment. She is a hardy pioneer species, deeply rooted in the humus of Bay Area counterculture. She has a degree in the art of living and diverse skills within the business, artistic, and familial realms. She is a devoted plant mistress, perhaps a dog owner, a high-quality organizer, and an agent for regenerative social systems, a founding member of the 13 Moon Collab at 13moon collaborative.com. She works to awaken people to their own agency in the creation of a world based on permaculture ethics of earth care, people care, and fair share. Delia, welcome to Post Carbon Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
And from the North Bay, we have co-organizer Jay Markert. Jay Markert is a regenerative design consultant, educator, permaculture teacher, community organizer, event producer, and social entrepreneur. Jay works with organizations, businesses, and communities, designing, organizing, and facilitating projects, trainings, events, and initiatives for personal, ecological, and social transformation in the West Coast, the United States, and internationally. Welcome to Post Carbon Radio, Jay.
Jay, are you with us?
Me.
All right.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Great. Well, let's see. I guess we can trade off with the questions. Jay, this is the second annual convergence, right? Tell us what happened last year and how the first convergence came about. What got you all started?
Well, this is a kind of unique event this year, as it's a combination of convergences. So this is the second North American convergence, which happened biannually. The first one they did in Minnesota years ago. But actually, in this region here in California, this would be our 11th Northern California convergence, which originally started out as the Bay Area convergence, then grew to more of the Northern California convergence. And just the last couple of years, we've expanded it even more broadly than just the permaculture community. It kind of grew from just the permaculture convergence to the building resilient communities convergence. So still building off of our base of the permaculture community, the permaculture movement, we're really wanting to make more relationships with those in the community that are, say, doing permaculture, but not necessarily calling that. So it's the second North American convergence and the 11th Northern California convergence.
I think, there we go. Thank you for that, Jay. And so how many people came last year?
I think last year we had close to 600 people came to the entire thing. It's been kind of growing substantially each year. I can remember 6 or 7 years ago when, you know, there was less than 100 people, and it was very much more grassroots and sharing and potluck style, and it's been really exciting to see it been really growing each year. So this year, especially being the North American, we expect it to be even larger than it was last year.
Well, it certainly is a natural alliance between the two groups, because if we're going to have resilient communities, we need to grow great food, and that's what we learned from permaculture, right?
Certainly. I think we all have different gifts and are all holding various kinds of pieces, and it's all about sharing the information that we know in our various communities. That's kind of been one thing with the permaculture convergences is this, which happened all across the world, by the way, regionally, where that community comes together to really share their best practices, also to share music and song and to celebrate and to learn how we can better design sustainable human settlements.
Delia, I'd like to bring you into the conversation. Do you want to add anything to what Jay's said so far?
Well, Jay's spot on. I've been involved in organizing these convergences since 2011 and have seen many more people become involved. I feel like an important piece of this is we strive to maintain that grassroots feeling no matter how many people come, because the fact of the matter is permaculture since the 1970s has been a movement that is very grassroots. There have been small teachers all over the world teaching small groups of people about permaculture, and those inspired groups of people have gone on to do a myriad of different things. And, you know, permaculture is about a lot more than just growing food. It's actually about creating regenerative landscapes, not only landscapes, but social structures and culture.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to playing the interview we did with Wanda, because she has such a focus on the regenerative and healing aspects from traumatic histories of African Americans.
Right.
Yeah. So when I went to the website, I saw huge open spaces. I saw pathways and forests cultivated in grassy fields, a tiny little house in a big open air shelter, field of sunflowers. There were kids, drums, and a first aid hut. What is it like for people to be on site at the Solar Living Institute for those who've never been there?
Well, it's going to be very comfortable. First of all, the Solar Living Institute is just a stunning development. You know, I think the first time I was there was 20 years ago when they were just open, and they have turned their, I believe it's 11 acres, really into a permaculture-inspired oasis. They're managing the water that's on site. They're lucky enough to have a spring, and they have demonstration systems. The entire site is solar-powered. Everything that they're doing is really right in line with the permaculture techniques. So we're excited to be there, and people who come will be able to camp on site. There will be many places to hang out, and nine classrooms, and a main stage with music at night. It's going to be exciting and comfortable. We even have what's known as the MASH Clinic, which is a collective of women who are medical practitioners and herbalists who specialize in going to festivals to support people on site. And that's new for us this year. We're very excited to have the MASH clinic with us.
I believe Hopland is north on 101. How far is it up face from, well, we're in Point Reyes.
From the East Bay, Hopland is about an hour and a half without traffic. It's the first city that you come to when you cross the Mendocino County line.
Okay. The website logo for the Convergence features a string of prayer flags with slogans like Fair Share, Earth Care, People Care, and flags, U.S., Canada, California Bear Flag, and is it Mexico? Tell us what those slogans and flags represent. Let's start with Fair Share.
Well, Fair Share is one of the foundational ethics of the permaculture design methodology. They actually sort of go in order of earth care, people care, and fair share. When you take a step back and look at these, you understand that really this is what you teach your five-year-old growing up about how to comport yourself in the world. We want to take care of the earth. We want to take care of each other, and we want to make sure that we return the surplus so that the system continues to regenerate as opposed to the extractive system that we're currently embroiled in. If you take those same ethics and you put them in circles on a Venn diagram, you'll see that there's a place where all three circles intersect. And as permaculturists, we work to attain our behavior such that everything we do is in the center of that Venn diagram. That's a tall order and really a life's work.
If you're just joining us, this is Polk's Carbon Radio on KWMR, and we're talking with Jay Markert and Delia Carroll, two of the organizers of the second annual Permaculture Convergence in Building Resilient Communities, happening later this week in Hopland. Let's see, what day does it start?
September 14th.
14th through the 18th, I believe.
That's right.
And I'm your host, Bing Gong, and co-host, Karen Nyhus. Now, people can register for the Convergence, I think, by going to your website. And what is that website?
That website is permacultureconvergence.com, all one word.
And, Jay, can you tell us a little bit about the workshops, the pre- and post-workshops in the East Bay, and there's another one in the North Bay, too, right?
Sure, yeah. I would just start by adding just a comment on those flag thing, which relates to this, in that so this is it's the North American conversion, not just the American conversion. So mm-hmm. we are really intending to have some people coming from the South, as well as from Canada, as well as Indigenous people. So that was the intention. It's not just, you know, the national conversion, but the North American. So given that people are going to be coming from out of town across America, there's really a lot of amazing stuff going on here in the Bay Area. Really, really amazing sights to see. I think here in Northern California, we're a lot, some could say, further along than some other parts of the country in gardens and programs and things. So we're doing these pre and post tours. The first one would be tomorrow, actually, Tuesday, and then one after on Monday, visiting sites, some kind of primo permaculture-inspired sites in the East Bay, which is tomorrow, and then the North Bay after the conversion.
And are those separate from the conference? Can people register for them separately, or do you have to attend them together?
Yeah, those are entirely separate through our partner, Bay Area Green Tours is putting those on, and people can come just on the tours, or they can just come for one day, or come for the first few days are going to be more focused on Wednesday, Thursday are more the North American convergence, which are more councils and working groups and open space, also a plethora of workshops. And then toward the weekend, it will get probably larger being the weekend, and we have even more workshops come happening. And it's really a spectacular array of workshops. I include anyone to just check out the website. Each time I go on there and update one, I'm like, wow, these are really some amazing offerings, everything from gardens to governments and everything in between you think you can apply permaculture to. So it's going to be really spectacular. We're excited about it.
Yeah, we were really impressed looking at your website. Just like you said, that there was representation from Native America, North America, and, you know, Africa, Asia, really, truly international. Who are some of the speakers or some of the topics that are new since last year that you would highlight for anyone who's been before?
Well, that's a good question. Gosh, there's so many. I mean, we have a lot of our local well-known permaculture rock stars, dare I say, but like Penny Livingston Stark and James Stark right here from Bolinas at the Regenerative Design Institute. They're of course coming, and many other, you know, most all the people that they teach permaculture courses or run permaculture courses in, you know, from Southern California to Oregon and across the country are going to be present and doing a variety of different workshops. And then beyond that, we're also bringing in some different special guests. Like we have this man coming from Africa, Bayou. Well, he's from Africa, but he was in India, and he's been doing some amazing international sustainable development work and social justice work. He's a highlight. We have some people from India coming who are some of the organizers of the International Conversion, which happens also every 2 years. The next one's going to be in India, and not this fall, but next fall. So they're coming. And we're the theme this year being building bridges. There's lots of different kinds of panels and conversations happening about bringing, you know, building bridges with other movements, with the climate justice movement, with the food justice movement, with land access, with Indigenous people. So there'll be lots of those kinds of conversations happening as well, and kind of putting people together on a panel or a working group that are kind of from different sectors of looking at how we can build greater strength and resiliency in our movement across the board based on our shared ethics and a vision for a happier, healthier planet.
Yeah, we heard Wanda talk about sort of an older model of permaculture and a new one that's emerging. And she also talked about, along with that, two generations of permaculturalists, that there's a new younger generation coming up that may frame things differently with a deeper politics. Dealey, do you want to jump in on that?
Yeah, that's actually accurate. You know, for years and years, at the end of any permaculture course, and we call the really survey course for permaculture, permaculture design certificate course. And teachers have said, well, now it's up to you, take this and run with it. And that thousands of people have heard that, and they have. And here in particular, in the great diversity of the Bay Area, We have a lot of people of color who are now inoculated into permaculture and understanding that really permaculture reframed ancient techniques for living on the land for the modern dominant culture's mindset. So there's an active conversation going on now about how do we decolonize permaculture. As a matter of fact, one of our keynote panels, I believe it's on Friday night, is going to be just that subject. So it's sure to be a really interesting and thought-provoking conversation.
Yeah, and I'm going to give listeners another preview. We're trying to bring you the audio of our wonderful conversation with Wanda last week. We're having a little bit of a glitch, so we're very pleased to have Jay and Delia with us if they can stay on the line a few more minutes. One of the things Wanda spoke about was how African Americans in particular have had a traumatic legacy regarding that they were traumatized in the garden and on the plantation through slavery, and that a lot of African-American people had sort of run away from that entire scene because of that traumatic history, but that African-Americans like herself are working to reclaim that legacy, and all the wisdom and knowledge and experience they had with growing and cultivating really healthy food and medicine. So it sounds like you're getting very deep contributions from traditions all around the world that bring a deeper historical and cultural meaning to what permaculture is.
Well, that's exactly right. I think that, you know, if you look at people from Western culture who grew up disconnected from nature, it only makes sense that by the 1970s we would start to look around and understand that we were severed from our relationship with nature. And in a profound way, understanding the ethics of permaculture and looking at the world through the lens of what's called the permaculture practices, the permaculture, design techniques, is helping people to understand that we are nature and that what we need to do is ask to be included back into the natural world. And to take our place in the natural systems that support us all. We can't continue to divorce ourselves from those systems and believe that we can live to tell about it. Mm-hmm. Right? We have to reinsert ourselves back into the web of life and everything that supports it. Permaculture is an honest attempt to do that. Has a long way to go, and you know, part of what we do at these convergences is take a step back and look at how we've done and get feedback from all the people who are involved and decide on new directions forward. You know, a large part of the first 2 days of the convergence are what's known as working groups, and they will be groups of interested people meeting on pretty much self-generated subjects. A big one right now is climate change. I know that Starhawk has really taken this on as a personal mission, and she'll be involved in the climate change working groups, which are seeking to come up with a unified approach to climate change from the permaculture community.
Yeah.
A lot of that stuff is going
mm-hmm.
on.
Yeah, Wanda told us that last year her experience was she was in a number of fora at the convergence, and the issue of race and racism came up, and people really wanted to get into it, but there wasn't enough time. And so it was very encouraging to hear. It sounds like you've really programmed more time for that for those conversations to take place in a more expansive, relaxed way, and as she said, in a safe space.
That's right. As a matter of fact, we have a 3-hour session scheduled for Saturday entitled Courageous Conversations, and it's going to be facilitated by international permaculturist Jillian Hovey and local permaculturist Rachel Kaplan, who happens to be one of my partners in the 13 Moon Collab. Rachel is also a somatic therapist and holds a lot of skills about holding space for people to have the difficult conversations mm-hmm. that we're all aware of and we don't really know how to address. So we're going to be attempting to do some of that during a 3-hour workshop on Saturday.
Well, we hope that folks' appetites have been whetted for considering attending the Permaculture Convergence. Is registration still open?
Yes, it is.
All right.
Come for the day or the whole time.
And also for the events.
And the pre-event.
The pre-event and the post-event, which will be tomorrow, correct? And then again on Monday the 19th.
I believe that's true.
All right. So we want to thank so much Jay Markert and Delia Carroll for being on with us at Post Carbon Radio. And if you want to register for the conference, remind us to go to
PermacultureConvergence.com.
Great. And Delia, your website is 13moonCollaborative.com.
That's right.
And Jay, do you have any other websites you would like to mention?
Sure. LivingMandala.com, one of the production partners, as well as EmpowermentWorks.org.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being on Post Carbon Radio.
Thank you very much.
Wanda Stewart is an urban farmer and homesteader, educator, mother of twins, and a comrade to many in the movement to educate and inspire others to grow their own food and communities. She believes that the skills to grow food and medicine, to maintain a healthy body, mind, and spirit, and to live cooperatively and communally are essential to our collective survival. She is committed especially to working with other African Americans to reframe our shared history, trauma, and greatness through the act of legacy gardening. As current program director for the Victory Garden Foundation, former executive director of the People's Grocery, longtime school administrator, master gardener, and certified permaculturalist, Wanda blends her professional skills in community outreach and program development with her personal passions for people and urban farming. She seeks to model, galvanize, and support whole life transformation in individuals and in community through the act of gardening and the lens of African American culture and traditions. Starting with Permaculture Zone 00, Wanda is creating Obsidian Farm, her land in the flatlands of Berkeley, California, that models a new way of living in an urban environment. With landscaping that is nearly 100% edible and 20 chickens in a side yard, it is part food forest, part oasis, part community center, and all home. Everyone is welcome to learn and grow in the diverse, intentional community effort that celebrates gardens and the soul of Black folk. Drawing on past lessons while moving into the future, her fearlessness in stepping forward, speaking, and acting in ways that disrupt the status quo, work across culture, and ensure that folks actually eat well is only emboldened. Specializing in garden-centered wellness, visionary program development, and the facilitation of courageous conversations about race and our environment, she knows in her heart that we must, quote, grow the power. Wanda, welcome to Post Carbon Radio.
Good morning. Thank you.
Wanda, you've done a lot. Let's start in locating your work in Oakland. It's a majority people of color city, just like all of California. And in the early 2000s, talk of food deserts was common, and Oakland was a leader in addressing it through places like the People's Grocery, where you served as executive director. Let's start off by what do we mean by a food desert, and how did the People's Grocery help address it in Oakland?
Defining a food desert is simply a place where there's not a lot of existing food, particularly healthy food. And it's pretty hard to imagine West Oakland is a very large place or large section of the city, more than 75,000 people living in that area, and there's no supermarket at all serving that entire population. So if you live in West Oakland, and particularly if you don't have a car, you're often obligated to shop at corner stores, which promote hot chips, Cheetos, and sugary soda drinks. So the notion about being able to build health and wellness in a community is somewhat of a moot point because it just can't be had close by. I would watch when I worked in West Oakland, families load up to get on a bus, and you've got a mom and you have two little babies and a shopping cart, and everybody gets on the bus and figures out how to make it work to get to the nearest supermarket. But even that doesn't work for most people. People's Grocery began serving in West Oakland nearly 15 years ago. And there was a time when People's Grocery had 11 or 12 gardens growing all over the city and even beyond the city. And they'd collect that and have a mobile market that rode through the streets of West Oakland selling food out of the back of a school bus. People loved it, and it served everyone and served the community well. Unfortunately, it wasn't especially profitable and sustainable. So People's Grocery has become a place where we're teaching people to grow food in a smaller locations, encouraging them to come and get vegetables from that location, talking to them about entrepreneurship and how to create food businesses, and working to just embolden and engage the community, particularly now in a time of really serious pressures around the issues of gentrification. One point of good news is that the original founder of People's Grocery is a guy named Brahm Amati, and he has finally, after 3 or 4 years of trying to identify land and space, has found a way to open the People's Community Market. And that has always been its dream and part of the People's Grocery's mission. So when this market opens in about a year or so from now, it will be a grocery store right in the heart of West Oakland where people can come to shop, they can come to learn. It will be part community center so folks can gather and teach and work together.
Great. So that was actually my next question, was sort of what lessons were learned from the People's Grocery experience. It sounds like people are still doing it, and it's still evolving. How did it motivate you and inform and inspire you to the next steps and the things you're working on now, what you learned from People's Grocery?
I would have to say I was only with People's Grocery for 6 months, and it was a wonderful opportunity that ended in a really challenging way. And so I'd say the greatest lesson I learned, or at least what has moved me forward, is the dilemma with nonprofits and particularly working in communities of color. It's really important to me that African Americans in particular, just because that's my personal zone 00 in permaculture speak, actually learn to grow food and use it differently to benefit their health and nutrition. And one of my experiences are that nonprofits get very challenged about being able to deliver the services and fulfill their missions in very practical ways. So for me, I wanted to really reach out to the people. I didn't want to write grants and get money to create programs that people didn't actually attend, or to hold workshops where there were two or three folks that would show up. I also came to learn about some of the, I'll call it racial strife. I'm not sure that strife is exactly the right word that I want to use, but there's some real disconnects. Often in the nonprofits, we have white people who are trying to help the black people, particularly in West Oakland, with their high blood pressure and their diabetes and cancer and these kinds of related illnesses. And what we would find is we'd have young, very well-meaning white women trying to talk old, dyed-in-the-wool black women to not put ham hocks in their collard greens, and to instead take collard green leaves and roll them in burritos, like a burrito. And there was just a lot of miscommunication happening, and people weren't really learning. So I, as a black female, can step into the picture and step to center and begin to talk to people from my cultural perspective about these kinds of issues. Although I must be the first to admit that every time I begin to talk to my people about taking the meat out of the collard greens, it's not an easy conversation at all. There is a lot of old habits that need to be extinguished, and Habits Die Hard. So now I'm working in West Oakland in a school that sits at the heart of West Oakland so that we can work with children. I'm working with preschoolers to fifth graders, and it's easier to teach folks how to eat well from the beginning than try to change their habits when they're older.
In your bio, it says you created Obsidian Farm. Is that your
yes.
own land in the
yes.
flatlands of Berkeley? Uh-huh.
Yes.
And then the garden in West Oakland is another garden that you're working in. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about each one, please.
Obsidian Farm is my home and my oasis. I moved to Berkeley in 2000 after living for 10 years in boarding schools, particularly one in Central California that had a lush 12-acre organic garden where I learned firsthand to appreciate good homegrown organic food. So when I moved to Berkeley, I was shocked at the cost of organic produce, shocked at the cost of eggs from farmers, and in just an opportunity, I actually had to put a fence around my house because it was a newly purchased property. The gentleman who did that asked me, did I want a garden, and we put in a few garden beds. That was probably 10 years ago, and those three little garden beds no longer exist, but now the landscaping around my house is nearly 100% edible, with lots of fruit trees and perennial crops like chayote and callaloo and hops. And then I grow annual vegetables as well. And I added the chickens under a cedar tree because nothing could grow there, and now I've even added a turkey to that mix. The nice thing about that property is that it sits in the flatlands of Berkeley, but the largest part of the gardens are out in front of the house right at the sidewalk. So it's become a place where I meet my neighbors and share food with my neighbors and share tips. And across those 10 years, all of the people around me in the surrounding homes are also growing food. And so now we're bartering and trading and sharing tips, and I give them eggs and chicken manure. And it's remarkable the community that you can grow while you're growing a garden. In South Berkeley, where I live, gentrification is an issue there as well, although it's not as pressurized a situation as it is in West Oakland. But one of the things I love are the ways in which I've learned more about my neighbors because of it. So, for instance, there's a Chinese senior lady who would walk our neighborhood listening to Chinese opera on her transistor radio. And she was pretty distrusting of me initially. And every day I'd give her something as she walked by. I'd give her a few figs or a few green beans and some tomatoes. And very shortly thereafter, we became friends, and now we hug and we kiss, and I know her family and keep track of her health and well-being. So it's just a wonderful opportunity. We hold classes there, and preschools stop. It becomes a sort of neighborhood destination for lots of folks who are walking around. And a great point of pride for me, I'm amazed at how many people stop to talk to me about my garden and compliment it. The new garden that I'm working at in West Oakland is at the Hoover Elementary School. And it's a remarkable, I was about to say little garden, but it's actually a huge garden. The school property takes up what amounts to about two city blocks. And the garden is out on the back 40. I have been blessed to inherit a garden with really good bones. So there's a big shade structure and an outdoor teaching classroom and about 20 fruit trees that have been put together and placed through an organization called Growing Together. The Sierra Club has also planted a grove of native species trees, even including redwoods, that are baby trees for now, but are growing. So we have this, again, another opportunity to create a real oasis for people in the neighborhood as well as a gathering spot. That garden happens to be located a block and a half from a site where a young muralist, his name was Antonio Ramos, who was actually a student of mine many years back, he was murdered there while painting a mural. And that situation was something that impacted this school and this neighborhood in really deep and significant ways. So I'm hoping that this garden will also be a place where neighbors can gather and get to know each other, despite their cultural differences. The cultural makeup of the school is pretty remarkable. They're primarily Black students with a healthy dose of Latino and Arabic, mostly Yemeni people, with a few Asian folks, and even two white kids. So the garden, again, sitting here in the heart of this ghetto, can bring everybody out of their houses, and we can work together to grow food and feed the people. I'm really excited about it. Hoover is a school, for me, like I've never experienced. I've worked in a very broad range of schools, from exclusive private schools and boarding schools to day schools and public schools in Berkeley and Oakland and Emeryville. And the thing that concerns me most about my new students at Hoover is that, generally speaking, they're really hungry. And it's just that pure and simple. We know that the kids that come to this school are twice as likely not to have had breakfast as compared to the other students in Oakland School District. So the opportunity to teach them to grow their own food and empower them and to actually feed them in a way that nourishes their bodies and their brains so that they can learn in the classroom is essential and important to me.
If you're just joining us, you've been listening to the voice of Wanda Stewart on Post Carbon Radio. We are talking about the upcoming permaculture convergence in Hopland, California this week, Wednesday through Sunday. And Wanda is one of the presenters. She has a vast experience, as you can hear, in gardening, permaculture, and many other activities in building community, and particular expertise in the traditions and healing powers of the African-American tradition. Wanda, so you've just been talking about addressing straight-up hunger, but we also noticed in your bio that you not only grow food, you also grow medicine. Talk about that.
Yes, well, first of all, food is medicine. I feel a difference in my body since I've begun to eat this way. I no longer need to take my high blood pressure medicine. I've lost about 20 pounds and have been able to maintain that. Need to do some more, but it's remarkable that just eating healthily will improve your body. Collard greens, for example, are indicated for curing cancer. So, again, in the African American diet, if we eat well and we eat the food that we grow, we are healing our bodies and using it as medicine. But I also certainly grow herbs that we are more accustomed to thinking as medicine. I use mullein and wormwood and St. John's wort, but I also have the culinary herbs that have healing properties like sage and parsley. I have a wonderful old school food / medicine called pokeweed. And pokeweed is actually a weed, but it's amazingly medicinal along the lines of bitter herbs. If I make a pot of soup with pokeweed, the entire house gets healthy, you know, in the wintertime when everybody feels a little bit croupy. If you go on the internet, you're going to read that pokeweed is poisonous. I promise you that it's not poisonous if you cook it, and it's actually, like I said, a wonderful healing herb. So it's learning about herbs, and also learning about how the ways in which we use our food will heal our bodies.
That's wonderful. You said that you teach kids how to grow foods. How do they respond to that?
You know, it's funny. First of all, everybody, once you get them into the garden, gets attracted to something and can find something to do there that they love. But my students are eager and really happy to do it. A first grade boy with a shovel and a pile of dirt is a really happy, happy person. They almost don't care whether they're growing any food or not. But the opportunity to plant a seed in the dirt and water that and watch it grow is an amazing demonstration of faith, right? Because it's kind of hard to believe sometimes that you can take a teeny-weeny little mullein seed that's smaller than a poppy seed, put it in some soil, water it, and it grows into this giant plant with big stalks that can help you with your asthma, right? That's a real act of faith. And when we can teach them that that kind of thing happens, we're really changing their world and their perception. They also just love to eat what they grow. I played with some children in the garden yesterday, and they discovered the strawberries that had been growing. And they discovered that not all the strawberries were red. Some of them were white, and they were ripe and supposed to be white. So they love making those kinds of discoveries. We have a giant sunflower. It's the largest sunflower I've ever seen in my life. And the kids were amazed to put the connections between the seeds that came out of the sunflower and the seeds that come out of the packages when they buy them from the corner store. It never occurred to them that they could grow their own sunflower seeds rather than pay the corner store for their snack. So I think they're very open. I know they're very open. And then for all of us, there's some hormonal activities that happen in our body simply because of putting our hands in the soil. And it's a real legitimate buzz or a high. So without calling it that for the students, just getting them to put their hands in the dirt and be in touch with the earth really connects them with that wonderful feeling that we get. It could be that the young man with ADHD is a calmer student by virtue of having spent a little time in the garden. You know, the new students that I have now have quite a lot of trauma in their lives. And one young boy, his mom died over the summer, and she'd been living in the streets in San Francisco. And he's having a really hard time with it, such that it's really hard for him to stay in the classroom. So the principal asked me, can we go and have him plant some sort of plant in the garden in memory of his mom, and then he'll go out there and water it when he needs to leave the classroom. And it's working. And the most remarkable thing is that not only did we plant a wonderful Cape gooseberry for his mom and actually a lemon verbena for his grandmother who died too, he comes out and waters that. But since that event, he also hasn't needed to leave the classroom. He's been actually able to stay in the classroom and begin to focus on his schoolwork. And while he may not consider that a good and fun thing, it is. He's learning. He's calming down. He's coming back to a center where we can really reach to him and bring him along.
Well, back to food. You're providing food to your community in Oakland, and you told us a little bit about that earlier. And you also mentioned some of the cultural diversity around where you live and work. You mentioned Yemenis, other Arab Americans, the Chinese woman that you offered food to and have developed this relationship with. What other cultural groups are around where you're doing your gardening, and how are you reaching out and connecting with them?
I think that there's a little bit of everybody. I am originally from Philadelphia, where there may be a certain diversity, but people tend to relate pretty singularly to their own folks. What I love about living in the Bay Area is that there's a little bit of everybody here, And we don't quite have the cultural boundaries here that you find in other places. So, again, I really believe it's the, I'll call it cure for the pressures of gentrification. We know that our neighborhoods are changing significantly, and there's nothing that we can do about that. So when I talk with people about the effects of gentrification, one of the realities are that the white people aren't going to go away. This is a neighborhood where investments in real estate are very, very lucrative, and it's the new place to live. So I believe that when we bring everybody together in these gardens, we can get acquainted with each other. I also believe and know that if black people and the traditional folks that have occupied and lived in this community and, quite frankly, built this community want to be able to stay here, we need to improve our health. We need to improve our businesses and create businesses that allow for us to financially stay in place and not be displaced. So I think there's a rainbow of people here, and that's what I love about this gardening and farming thing. You grow a garden, and you can grow a community.
That's wonderful. Your bio says that you're committed especially to working with other African Americans to reframe our shared history, trauma, and greatness through the act of legacy gardening. Could you tell us what legacy gardening is and how it helps to reframe the history and the trauma that you've experienced?
Yeah. So African Americans, at the onset of our history on this land in the United States, we were traumatized in gardens. We were traumatized on plantations. So when we secured freedom, we went running from those traumas, and understandably so. So often I will hear particularly teenaged black kids will say, I don't want to do gardening. I'm not trying to get dirty. I don't want to look like a slave. And we turned our backs on gardens, but we also left a lot of greatness there. I was very much motivated by a photograph that I saw on Facebook one day. It was a picture of four former slave women, and all of them were over 100 years old in the photo, and one of them was as old as 125. And the strength and the resilience that they demonstrated was remarkable. And I heard myself think and was instantly shamed by the thought of thinking slavery couldn't have been all that bad, right? And that's a horrendous thought to think. But when I allowed myself to continue to consider that, what I realized for me is that when we were working on the plantations, we were, one, eating organic, healthy food that we grew ourselves. That, two, we were doing that in community, shoulder to shoulder with people that we had to live with and rely upon for survival. And that, three, we had a spiritual connection to the land that we were living on. So we lost all of that when we gained freedom and were able to remove ourselves from the traumatic part of that. So now what I'd like to do, honestly, is take us back to the garden, take us back to the site of the trauma, and reclaim our history there. When I'm working with folks, the people in West Oakland tended to have migrated to West Oakland from the South, Louisiana, Arkansas, Texas, Mississippi, back in the 20s and 30s and 40s. So when I talk to my students' parents, they remember going to down south in the summers and working with Granny in her garden there, right? We had all the skills to do it,
We just stopped using them. So going back to it, we can reclaim all of that and reclaim our health as well. So much like permaculture focuses on the growing tradition of indigenous people, African Americans and Africans are indigenous folks, and we know how to do this, and we have ways, and it's important for us to go back and reclaim that.
So we're talking with Wanda Stewart. As you've just heard, she has a rich wealth of experience, not only in permaculture, which is the upcoming event this week, the Permaculture Convergence, second annual in Hopley, California, but also particularly in the history of African-American involvement in food, cultural preservation, surviving incredible, the history of slavery, and what she can bring forward from that experience. So if you want to come learn from Wanda, we encourage you to look at the Permaculture Gathering in Hopland, California. As we move to wrap up, Wanda, tell us about the Victory Garden Foundation, where you were the director.
I was working with the Victory Garden Foundation, and unfortunately that foundation was started by a remarkable African-American master gardener named Victory Lee. And her agenda was the same as the one that I've been sharing here, to teach children in particular, but people in general, how to grow food and grow community. Sadly, Victory died this winter, and with her, the foundation had to shut down. But all of us who loved her very much, and her birthday was just yesterday, are continuing her work in and around Oakland to do that work. She believed that it was essential, and she was phenomenal at it.
So were you at the first Permaculture Convergence? And if so, what was your experience?
It was a remarkable experience. I tend to be a person who loves to get with other people who are growing food and talking about the earth's resources and how to utilize them and create sustainable environment and a sustainable lifestyle. And it was 700 or 800 like-minded folks for a weekend of camping and eating good food and learning and playing and partying together. So it was a thrill for me. I also presented at the last conference about our shared trauma in the land and discovered that there were many, many people who were interested in talking about the people part of permaculture. And certainly a lot of people who were very interested in talking about race. And we didn't have enough time to do it. So one of the things I chose to do was to get involved in organizing this coming Permaculture Convergence. So we created this theme of building bridges with the interest of, let's talk and have courageous conversations across race, across class, across geography, across gender, across generation. You know, we permaculturalists, there's the old school way of doing permaculture, and there's a growing new school way. So we decided to create a situation where we could spend a weekend together having those kinds of conversations, which are so vital now for the world we're living in and where our country is. So I would encourage people who are interested in seriously considering those kinds of topics in a safe environment that's also fun to come. It really is a great time. I believe that we can, again, grow a new kind of community in a way that is sustainable for all people and all cultures.
That's so great. Wanda, it's been really wonderful talking to you, and good luck in Hopland. I hope to meet you in person someday.
That would be wonderful. Thank you.
And tell us, when are you presenting at the Convergence?
I will be on a panel on Sunday about resilient homes. I will be facilitating a panel on food justice through the lens of race on Saturday evening. And then we'll be there generally helping to organize and administrate the event. So I'll be there from Thursday through Sunday.
Great. Wanda, thank you so much for being on Post Carbon Radio.
Thank you.